Jeff Norman, the Norman Report.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Your voices are pitch perfect, as always. It is the Norman Report, and I must be Jeff Norman, and I am pleased to have in the studio tonight Geza X and Cameron Melville, who are connected in more than one way, but in particular, they are very much integral figures in a venue in downtown Los Angeles called The Vortex, and we'll be talking about that tonight. The Vortex is sort of a hotbed of community activism, and there's a lot of arts-oriented stuff that goes on in connection with that activism, and that's a synthesis that I really love quite a bit, so I'm very excited to be a part of it. I know you guys are, let's just say hello, first of all. Hi, Geza. Hi, Cameron.
Hi, Jeff.
Hello there.
Hello there. You gentlemen, I noticed, arrived early. I don't know, were you listening at all to the previous show?
Yeah, it was great.
Oh, well, thanks. I wasn't fishing for a compliment, but I could have talked to that cop all night long. And I got the feeling, maybe it's just my imagination, but was I pushing it too much with him? I mean, it didn't, to me.
You always push it too much.
I think it comes natural to you, Joe.
I wasn't trying to hold him accountable for anything. I'm really just curious.
Yeah.
Of course not. Just trying to draw some information out of him. And, you know, he did a great job. I mean, they have to say what they have to say. He couldn't answer a lot of the questions that were asked. You know, he was, you know, more responsible for local events. And, you know, when you ask him a more generalized question like that about, like, something that happens in another, you know, there was a call in asking for some kind of, you know, advice. And what can he do? He can't do that much because he wouldn't know the circumstances.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I wasn't expecting him to get into specifics on that. I would have liked the opportunity to get a little more deeper about, you know, the emotional aspect of being a cop. Maybe that's not something they like to talk about at all.
I don't think you're going to get that, Jeff.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
It's a tricky and complex question, too. It was kind of a, you know, like a multi-layered question. And so it's...
Yeah, he said he didn't really understand what I was after. I may not have asked it in a good way, you know. I'm really just curious. Maybe this is more of a barroom conversation.
That's what I'm thinking. A couple of cocktails and then police emotion.
I'm just curious what it's like to be a cop. I mean,
how do you size someone up just when you first kind of see them, and then what are the kind of decisions run through your head? I think that was what the question was about.
Yeah, and that's really the I feel a lot of empathy for cops. That seems to me to be the most difficult, or one of the most difficult parts of their job.
There might be certain things about that they might not really be able to say, except perhaps privately, like in a bar or something like that, you know.
All right, so all the more reason to continue my habit of drinking heavily in the streets of Los Angeles. It's not just getting drunk, it's getting information.
That's right. Uh-huh.
So what cop bar can I go into?
I don't know. Don't know that.
You don't, huh? All right. So let's talk about the Vortex, and let's talk about who you two are in relation to that venue and to each other. The Vortex, you know, I'm not really sure how unique the Vortex is. I know that I think it's very unique, and maybe that's a question for you, Cameron. What strikes me about it is that you and your cousin Jeff, who are the co-owners, don't have any particular requirements as to who it is that uses it.
Correct.
You're more about how they're using it, what their work is.
Correct. What they're using it for.
Yeah, I mean, other places. And, you know, and you can get all kinds of venues where you pay the prevailing market rate, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But to get a venue as inexpensive as that is, and it's $100 is the fee, usually that's for nonprofits or there's usually some kind of very specific criteria attached to it. And I like that you two, it's what we think might be good for the community. Is that a fair way of saying what you base your decisions on when somebody wants to use it?
Sure. We ask people to articulate who they are and what their cause is and how they hope to raise money or consciousness for their cause. And if it's something we believe in and they fit our criteria, we look to support it. Simple as that.
Now, you are the offspring, if I may use the O word, of the founders of the Melville Charitable Trust. And people who listen to NPR probably recognize that name, because you'll often hear at the top of the hour that this or that was made possible by a grant from the Melville Charitable Trust.
It's so funny. I hear that. I've never heard it.
You've never heard it?
Not once.
Oh, my goodness.
But people keep telling me it's there. So it really, how does it do that voice again?
Made possible by a grant from the Melville Charitable Trust.
Excellent.
Whoa, well, thank you for that grant, because I'm enjoying this program.
So
you come from a family that has been involved in philanthropy.
Yes.
And sometimes kids follow in the footsteps of their parents, and sometimes they rebel. And I think you kind of did a little of both, or maybe a lot of both. Can you say a little bit about how you've navigated the relationship with your parents, and to what degree you're kind of following their footsteps versus, blazing a different trail?
Well, that's interesting. I certainly was rebellious as a young man. My parents and I had a legally mandated separation, I'll say. I left home at an early age. We ended up in court against each other, and I won those cases. Later in their life, and in
well,
my life.
What does that mean? Legally mandated, and you won the case. What did you win?
I was put in a psychiatric hospital when I was 15, and I was in there for 2 years. And at that age, the parents had the right to just put their child in. The child has no rights. The child can't sign themselves in. Mm-hmm. And the conventional wisdom was that you had to be 18 or over to petition for your own release, which is a process where you inform the hospital you want to be released in 10 days, and it's a whole process. But the law was interpreted as saying that you had to be 18 years old to enter into that process. And that was legally inconsistent. There was a huge loophole there, because the law never addressed that question, but did address how old you had to be to sign yourself in. And they said you had to be 16. So my case was simply the law should be consistent. If you're responsible enough at 16 to sign in, you should be responsible enough to sign out. And I won that case and became an emancipated minor, and it was a federal precedent. And so it's now held up as precedent. And then my parents sued me for commitment as if I was an adult, and they lost, and I was released.
And why did they want you institutionalized?
Well, I think by the end, I think they had their doubts about the wisdom of their decision there. Certainly in later years, they did.
I mean, you seem so mellow now. It's hard to imagine what it was that might have even been under consideration. Is that too personal a question? Were you getting in trouble with the law and stuff like that? Is that what we're talking about?
Minorly, nothing severely. I came from an advantaged background. I got bounced out of all my schools that I went to, and I was incorrigible kid. No, I wasn't out there doing, terribly illegal things, a little bit, but. These were the days of Freud, and my parents listened to the experts, and I ended up in Yale Psychiatric Institute.
Wow. And I heard you say on the Qumran report last night that you eventually patched things up with your.
Oh, yeah. I did, indeed.
So you do philanthropy also, but you don't do it like your parents do it.
Well, I suppose I do. It's funny, I certainly never set out to follow in my parents' footsteps in any sense. In fact, it sort of occurred to me rather late in the process that I was actually following in their footsteps with the vortex, things like that. I didn't really think of it as the same thing. I believe in the principles as I see them behind philanthropy, for sure.
Right. Well, why don't we show a little video footage of the vortex so people know what we're talking about. This is on Olympic Boulevard, 2341 East Olympic Boulevard, near the corner of Santa Fe Avenue in Los Angeles. And the website is vortexla.org. And we just have about a minute of footage to give people a taste of what the venue is.
Vortex is a large warehouse in downtown Los Angeles, just east of the city. 20,000 square feet. We have a 400-person event space, which features stage, lights, PA, webcasting, podcasting, editing and production facilities, offices, promotional services, all towards the end of promoting and executing low-cost fundraising events for nonprofits and other community organizations that need a helping hand. What is considered success is an organization that we support walking away with an improved situation financially and as far as consciousness goes. The idea being to water across the spectrum of the grassroots.
This is just a petri dish for people to come in and plant whatever they will. My personal view is to try to put as few boundaries on it as possible with a thrust towards moving society into a positive direction.
And that was Cousin Jeff Parker's voice at the end. He
Indeed.
Is the co-owner along with you. Jeff lives here in Los Angeles.
Indeed.
And you live where?
I live in upstate New York.
I'm looking for the exact address, please.
Yeah.
Okay. I got to learn to get information out of my guests more. They always manage to evade the question.
Hudson, New York.
Ah, I got a little more out of you. All right. Don't worry. I won't show up without calling first. So we also have Geza X with us here, and Geza has a rather storied past and I think a storied present and future as well. Geza, I don't even know all the things you've done with your life. I have a feeling you've done quite a bit that isn't on my radar, but I do know that you are considered a key figure, a seminal figure in the California punk rock scene. And you've produced many records for California punk bands such as Dead Kennedys and Black Flag, The Avengers, The Weirdos, The Germs. And you had a Billboard hit that you produced that I believe was on the charts for about 30 weeks. And that was a song called Bitch.
Correct.
Yeah. And I know you in your post-punk phase.
Mm-hmm.
And much like my impression of Cameron, I have a hard time reconciling who you are now with who I imagined you would have been before, because you're, like Cameron, very sweet and gentle. And we think of punk rock as being, you know, imbued with a lot of aggression. So are you a completely different person now, or were you, you know, more or less how you were then, but you were one of the softer people involved in the punk scene?
Well, I mean, there's several sides to that. I was, you know, definitely one of the softer people in the punk scene. If you consider my, you know, viewpoints on life, I was a hippie. You know, I grew up as a hippie. I was very politically active in the 60s. I was involved in a lot of demonstrations against the Vietnam War. I printed a lot of flyers and bumper stickers. In fact, I ran away from high school. Am I close enough?
There you go.
Oh, I thought you were talking to me. Okay, we have a request. Oh, all right, all right. Our board operator, Jenny, who's lovelier than Tupelo Honey, is trying to coax us into getting a little more intimate with the microphones. Yes, I understand. She wants us to sound good.
All right, I'm so loud in my headphones that maybe that's what it is.
Yeah.
But
hey, this is a sound professional you're dealing with here, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's all good.
All right.
So, yeah, I was involved in a lot of student demonstrations. I ran away from high school to go to the college at campuses and to help print up flyers. I was on the night shift at the, you know, the print shop there, and I learned a whole lot of things that way. And I, you know, went to Berkeley, and I was part of the People's Park demonstrations when they were trying to actually build a park. So Cameron and I have that in common. We come from a background of a lot of 60s activism, and, you know, we both really, really love the idea of people, if I may speak for you on this one thing, of people really rallying to you know, pick themselves up by their own bootstraps, and if they have something to say about society, to say it openly and to help do something meaningful. And so, you know, after that, after the 60s, I ended up back in L.A., and I was a musician. I'd started to play in a lot of bands. So I ended up in Los Angeles right before punk rock exploded. And so that's how I became, you know what the word seminal means? I mean, what it's derived from. No, that's how I became a seminal figure in punk rock, is that I was just there at the beginning. I have this crazy habit of showing up before anyone else does and sleeping on the floor until something happens. And I've done that in many recording studios in my life. I actually did it at the Vortex for a while. And that's what happened in the punk rock era. Also, there was a, you know, a movement that had not really gotten here from England yet, but there was just the beginnings of it. And I managed to plant myself in the right place at the right time. And I already had experience from the 60s, and so I was, you know, a rabble-rouser. And yeah, there was a lot of drunkenness and debauchery. And so the part of me that is nice is my personality, but the part of me that's crazy is the part that, you know, drank and did all of the drugs. And
right. And I don't mean to reduce...
the wild life.
I don't mean to reduce the genre of punk rock to just, you know, aggression. Some people had a more nuanced understanding of life than others. And there were some very valid political expressions made in very artful ways. You worked, I mentioned before, with Jello Biafra and Dead Kennedys. One doesn't necessarily have to agree with everything Jello says to recognize he's a very smart guy, and there's something going on there. What was your experience like working with him?
He was a really good friend of mine in those days, and we did a lot of stuff together. I used to go, you know, stay at his house when I would go to San Francisco. That I had three or four places that I was always welcome. And he's one of the funniest, most intelligent people, great storyteller. And he was very interested in politics, more so than a lot of the other punkers. Punk had several different sides to it. I would say that in Los Angeles, it had a very strong Dada element to it. It was artsy. And when it first started out, it was, you know, much more about freedom of expression and sort of the anti-this, anti-that being very Dada-like, you know, where something was elevated to museum status when it was like a urinal or something like that. And that was a typical Dada type of idea. So that's kind of like, you know, what punk rock was like in the Los Angeles area. But in San Francisco, they were more political. And Jello, of course, was very political. And so when he would do his albums, I used to love working with him because it'd be like an annual news report.
Now, I'm not sure if this was the same year, but I went to college in Boston, Emerson College, from 1977 to 81. And I had a little side business going on promoting concerts. And unlike other colleges where, you know, you sort of do it through the school, you're on a concert committee sort of thing, we actually were allowed to do it as our own business. We just had access to this venue.
Oh.
And we put up our own money and either made money or lost money. And since we didn't have to pay for the venue, we made money usually. And the wildest show we did by far was Dead Kennedys.
Oh, wow.
I've never seen anything like it. I mean, I was a disc jockey on the college station. And so, you know, I was aware of punk rock, but I wasn't deeply involved in that scene. And it was like exciting, but it felt dangerous, actually, in that room.
I used to roadie for a lot of bands, and I went up north with a band called the Screamers that was very popular in those days. And after a video recording, we met with these guys that were just kind of fresh out of college, and they were telling us that they were going to start this band. They were going to call it the Dead Kennedys, and I was thinking, wow, what a great name. I wonder if they're going to really be able to live up to it. And then on a subsequent tour, I was roadieing for the Screamers or some other band. I went up there, and the Dead Kennedys were playing. This was, you know, things happened very fast in those days. It was months later.
Well, when you come up with a great name like that, you just have to, even if the band's not ready.
So they were playing.
I had ideas like that, too, where it's like, you know, that's such a great title for a book. I got to start writing it.
So they were playing at this club that was the big, big hotspot for punk rock called the Mabuhay Gardens. And I went in there, and as I entered, I started to hear this thunderous sound. And I went to the front where the speakers were, and I didn't know who was playing. And it was them. It was the Dead Kennedys. And I started to hear the beginnings of this song, Holiday in Cambodia. That's one of the things I'm best known for recording. And I was listening to this song pouring off the stage, and Jello Biafra just doing this, you know. And I was just thinking, wow, I would love to have a chance to record that song. And then a month or two later, they called me and they asked me to record it because I had started to get a reputation as a producer for recording the Germs and a couple of other bands. And it's just, that's how it went in those days. The entire punk rock history is just a couple of 3 years in length. And then later on, there was a sort of a second wave that was called hardcore.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with that song, Holiday in Cambodia, produced by Geza X.
Thanks.
And we have about a minute of it that we'd like to play for folks right now. So there you have it, Holiday in Cambodia, produced by Geza X, performed by Dead Kennedys. Now, right. You rightfully say that's a good name. Cameron, do you agree? Is that a good name?
You know, it's funny. I remember the first time I heard that name, I was horrified.
Why? Because you have some sense of decency?
I was like, holy mackerel, really, Dead Kennedys. But yeah, it was it
definitely
was
pushing.
Definitely an eye opener.
Were they big on Cape Cod did they must have gotten flack from?
Oh,
some
did
point.
They ever? Yes, yeah. They got in so much trouble for a lot of different things. Nobody, you know, they got a lot of trouble for the name, of course, because you know that was obviously controversial. But the whole idea of punk rock was, you know, to sort of kind of pump up things that, you know, seemed bad, but in a way, by reversing them in the style of Dada, to sort of show the other side of it. In other words, it was sort of a way of saying something by either exaggerating it or changing it somehow. So,
right. Do you know if any members of the Kennedy family ever expressed any opinion about it?
That I don't know.
Wow. I'm talking about living members, not the actual dead Kennedys.
No.
Wow. What was I going to say about, I think I lost my thought, something about how, people, as a matter of taste, I can't remember.
I think the PTL, remember the televangelist organizations?
Oh, yeah, PTL.
They went nuts over the dead Kennedys, you know, they were playing the songs at half speed and backwards and stuff to, you know, supposedly there was
very odd
demonic
group.
Influences.
Very odd group.
Yeah.
You remember
Jim
and Tammy Faye, right?
Yeah.
Sam Kinison came out of that group too, you know that?
Really?
Yeah, Sam Kinison was a child preacher.
Oh, yeah, right, right.
Yeah, I know that part, yeah.
Right, and his stand-up has still had a preacher quality to it.
It did.
Of sorts, yeah.
Of sorts.
Yeah. So how do you two know each other?
We know each other. I met Geza through my cousin Jeff, who was here at Skid Row with me last night. And I believe at that time, Jeff and Geza were working together on a recording project. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, Jeff and I recorded some music together a number of times.
And we all were talking about the vision of the Vortex and what it could be. And again, as Geza, although I don't remember you curling up on the floor, but he was there at the very beginning before, you know, when it was starting to move, but it hadn't really materialized yet. And
and he still lives there, and Geza is the sound and light.
No, he works out there.
Oh, okay. He's there so often, it feels that way.
I know, it does.
and often helps with the sound and lights issues there.
Definitely.
And,
yeah.
I mean, what a great treasure to have, you know, somebody with such skill to make sure things sound look right.
For me, it's like, you know, it's an honor because Jeff actually was the one that brought me into it. I was looking for a venue to do sort of a club type of situation in Hollywood. And Jeff kept telling me that he and his cousin, Cameron, were looking for a building in downtown L.A. and that downtown L.A. was up and coming and that there was things going to be happening here. And I was sort of, well, I don't know, you know, I was kind of poo-pooing it at first. And he said, really, take this seriously because we're going to get a building sometime mm-hmm. and we're going to turn it into some kind of a venue that's going to be a, you know, useful thing. And I don't think that it was a fully fleshed out idea yet at the time, but they were looking for a space. And then when they got it, they invited me to, you know, just sort of chat with them. We were all friends by that time. And out of that, they had started developing a truly visionary idea, which you've already explained pretty much what it is to,
yeah.
you know, not. And
I remember way back when we all yeah. went out to dinner with, who's the guy who used to be the editor of LA?
Jay Levin.
Jay Levin. Is he either the founder of LA Weekly?
Founder
of LA Weekly.
I remember Jay. He's great.
Yeah. And lo and behold, it came to fruition. You walked the talk, baby.
It happened.
Wow, good for that. So
they spent years putting this place together because, of course, you know, in the city of L.A., there's a lot of, you know, difficulties passing the regulations and everything. And, you know, they had some problems with contractors and everything. So it really took a long time and a lot of patience for them to make that happen. And as they did, the idea of what it was began to coalesce more and more. And so what they did was they invited me to help them basically with the tech and, you know, just to help, you know, make the thing happen. And I gladly volunteered because it was such a wonderful idea to be able to do something both political, to do something for the community.
Yeah,
and,
it's great.
You know, to rally people around a sort of a central location. I've always thought that a location is the most important thing as far as bringing groups of people together.
Well, it's what makes it real.
Yeah.
And then from there, you can just build on it. I'm the founder of the Veterans Project. And,
right.
And we do some things there and have been for a while. But in recent months, the building has been working for me on multiple levels. And we've been meeting other people who have not necessarily the same agenda, but some similar interests and priorities, and it really is taking off now to be what I think you tell me if I'm right. The concept that you had in mind is now actually turning into reality.
It is indeed.
Yeah, we have you know, for example, with this homelessness issue, we focus on homeless veterans not because we don't care about other people, but because it's a veterans organization. But there are other people in town who focus on homelessness, period. So, I mean, there's an obvious connection there, and that's just one example. It's happening over and over again. So is there a way for folks to who want to use the venue to have their proposals considered?
There is. Visit our website, which is vortexla.org, and read our mission statement, and if it resonates with you, fill out the online application and hit submit. It's as simple as that.
And as folks saw in the video that we showed earlier, it's a bare-bones operation, so it's not quite the right venue for everybody. And if you're just one elderly person, for example, mm-hmm. it might be a bit burdensome because you have to physically set up the room and break it down. You know, this is what the people who organize the events do. But if you're somebody who's got some allies who can help make it happen, it's really an ideal situation because you can turn it into almost anything. It's a very large room and it's very adaptable. There are two stages and you could use both of them, one of them or neither of them. You can move them around on wheels. There's a PA system there that could be used. You could bring in your own PA system. It's really quite the place, and I don't think there's any place else like it.
I'm not aware of any place like it. We thought it was an original idea when we came up with it. I don't think we based it on anything.
And it's made possible by a grant from the son of the Merit of Hell Charitable Trust. Yeah,
it's a DIY location, you know, do it yourself, and it's designed to encourage teamwork and community spirit, and the general idea of it is to bring people together to support various causes. And that's such an important thing to mention, because these days we live in a society where people are being sort of driven apart from one another. They're much more isolated from one another. People spend a lot of time on their computers and on their phones and texting. And there isn't a lot of live community activity. Even the club scene is kind of like dying in a lot of ways. You know, you see back in the day, you know, bands would play and there'd be a lot of people attending these shows. It's harder and harder to pull people to shows because people like to stay at home. And of course, I think, you know, as a political notion, that's sort of encouraged by the powers that be, the sort of the largeness of the states that we live in, and the, you know, the kind of corporate bureaucracy that's sort of taken over the government these days. So in a lot of ways, we're being discouraged from getting together and to, you know, support causes that we believe in and to stand up for ourselves. We're being discouraged because, you know, it's more convenient for the large kind of power forces to keep us separated and alienated. So I think it's extremely important, and it's a very, very wise notion on Cameron and Jeff's part to create a community space that is designed to make the community pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. That's so important, because that's exactly the thing that's not happening in society anymore. And as people become more separated, all sorts of bad things happen to them. They become easy to indoctrinate. They become, in a sense, more insensitive to each other's needs. So there's a loss of compassion on a social level. And, I mean, places like this, Skid Row Studios, are wonderful because they bring that back. Same thing with the Vortex. The Vortex brings people together, and it literally forces them to apply teamwork and to help one another. So I think that's part of the thing that's so important about it, is that there's a lot of heart involved, and that's something that we are missing in society, and more being, you know, it's being taken out of society.
Right. Well, I want to ask you about the neighborhood that the Vortex is in, but let's get Jeff Parker in on this conversation. And he is Cameron's cousin and is the co-owner of the Vortex. Jeff, are you on the line now?
I am.
Hey,
how are you, Jeff?
I am succulent, my friend. How are you?
Sweet cheeks.
Gaza was just bowling us over with his very articulate views on community. And
oh, yeah.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about the neighborhood that it's in, and why don't we start the conversation there with you. When you and Cameron originally had the idea, did you zero in on the particular neighborhood for any reason? And I guess then we should identify the neighborhood. Is it considered the Downtown Arts District, or what do we call this neighborhood?
Well, we're a tiny bit outside of the Arts District. I think the Arts District ends at 7th Street, but when we were looking north of 7th Street, up closer to like 1st and 2nd Street, but we put a number of offers in on different buildings, and it was like a feeding frenzy at that point in time. It's been about 10 years ago, and there really wasn't much happening then, but even then, I think, you know, they had already made a couple stabs at trying to get this place to catch as an artist. District, and I think everyone had a hunch it was going to happen this time. They had some stuff in place with the city that allowed that to happen, some incentives, I think they called adaptive reuse, and an industrial enterprise zone, and some other incentives that kind of really brought in private money.
So, industrial, I think, is a way to describe the neighborhood. It still is largely industrial, and I think it used to be, if I'm not mistaken, almost completely industrial.
I believe it was called the Warehouse District.
Yeah. So is it then fair to say that the dreaded gentrification is not really at play in this neighborhood so much, since there never were poor people living there, or am I making an assumption that's not right?
Hard to say, Jeff.
I don't think a gentrification. I hate that word anyway, but I think it's just more of a change in use. It's going from industrial to creative, and so it's a real opportunity to take a piece of property that was obsolete, because LA was largely an industrial ghetto, because a lot of these buildings were obsolete and no longer really usable for that, and you know, taking it away from blight and turning it into something fun.
Yeah, well, that's my point. I don't see a downside here. In downtown, which is only a couple of miles away, there's tension, you know, between the people, the homeless people, the people who are very low-income individuals, and all this big money is coming in. And that's a serious question. I don't have any particular...
Tough one.
Yeah, it is. But I don't think that in the neighborhood where the Vortex is, that's so much of an issue. So what do you guys think about the neighborhood? This is home, so to speak, right? Well, I mean, well, at least when you're there. What do you think of the neighborhood, Jeff?
I mean, I love the neighborhood. I know that a lot of people are that came in, let's say, 5 years ago are rapidly getting disappointed because they're getting priced out up in the actual artist district. So there's this migration south into more of this kind of, you know, grittier area that are real artist working spaces. I hate to use that term too, as opposed to like condominiums.
Right, that's important, so, though.
Yeah, it is.
And can you say a little bit about what it's like to be involved in an enterprise like this? It seems like you have to wear at least two different hats. I'm thinking of, you know, the business aspect, and also there's a very creative arts-oriented thing going on as well.
Yeah, and there's a lot of politics that takes place, as you're aware of, you know, with the different kinds of people. And I think that we have a very unique mission statement where we're trying to please a lot of different people, and it's really interesting to see, for instance, if a filmmaker comes in, he sees our place as the place to shoot, or and if somebody comes in, they see it as a lecture hall, and another person might come in and see it as an artist studio, you know, and they want to put their twist onto our space, and they try to get us to slant at that, and we just want to keep it an empty space that anybody can do anything in. So that along with the politics of the city, you know the police, the local police, and the council district, and the, you know, just the neighborhood, which Geza, of course, is involved in, and you've had some interface with, having to deal with the police and things like that, and the legalities, and so there's a lot of different aspects of trying to run a place like this, more than I had ever anticipated, that's for sure.
Yeah, I would imagine so. And so you have sort of an arm's length relationship, I think, with most of the organizers who come in. You know, you guys take a look at what it is they want to do, and you make a decision, and you let them do their thing, and you don't tend to get involved. But sometimes you do, and I think that's been the case with some of my allies who are service providers, helping veterans deal with their issues, as well as helping veterans contribute to uplifting the community. And I just want to thank you and Cameron and Geza and everybody who's associated with the Vortex for that support. And why is it that you do seem to take more of an interest in veterans than some of the, you know, I don't feel like you just treat it as we're there
to use the
venue.
Well, veterans and homeless people, I think we take a specific interest in because... Cameron's family, of course, is very involved in eradicating homelessness in the state of Connecticut. So that's just kind of like comes with the territory. It's just kind of something that we do, just because we honor that and understand it and respect that. My dad was in the Marine Corps, a combat veteran, and I saw the effect that had on him. And had it not been for family, my father could have very well have been homeless. He didn't fare too well psychologically from being in combat. And as time wore on, he became less and less capable of holding down a job. And I think that happens to a lot of people that experience combat to come back and to mix in with society can be a real challenge.
Yeah. And Geza, do you have any particular connection to veterans?
Not really. What was important for me was that when Cameron and Jeff gave me the opportunity to, you know, my studio, I used to have a studio in Malibu called Satellite Park. And when I decided to close it down, they gave me the opportunity, really kind of granted me space to set it up there, because I had, you know, started to make some decisions about my own life. I've, you know, been, you know, recording indie music for most of my life, and, you know, I love the underground. I love underground culture. I always will. And so, but I wanted to do something a little different. I was getting older. I'd had many life-changing experiences, and I wanted to do something, you know, that really gave back to the culture. And, this isn't the 60s. People are doing things in a very different way, and not a lot of people are doing things that, I mean, I should take that back. There are a lot of meaningful organizations. But they gave me the opportunity to set up my studio gear in a room of the Vortex, and it gave me a lot of autonomy, actually, to run it as I, you know, whatever I, you know, saw fit. And the best organized and managed groups that came into the Vortex, because what I was going to do, basically, and what I am doing, is to provide media support for selected groups that show up at the Vortex that look like they're doing something really worthwhile. Because, you know, I can't help everyone, but I do have a studio there, and I want to, you know, provide media services to the Vortex in line with their mission statement. So my mission statement's sort of a subset of their mission statement. Well, the Veterans Project and its offshoot groups came in with a lot of really, really good projects, fully formed, functional, organized, that showed up every week, did a lot of good for the community. I started to see them as one of the most viable things, because I wanted to help the homeless as well. I wanted to help veterans. I wanted to help at-risk youth. And here were organizations coming out of the Veterans Project that were doing bits of all of those things. And so one of the first things that I did was, you know, as I was actually building the studio, I started speaking with Melvin, who runs the Drama Stage, which is an offshoot of the Veterans Project. And Melvin really impressed me from the beginning with his group because of what they were doing for veterans and conflict resolution skills that they were teaching, and they were helping homeless, and now they're getting involved with some at-risk youth organizations to help kids. And I fell in love with what they were doing, and I just approached Melvin and said, hey, you know, I'd like to work with you guys. You know, you're sort of the perfect template for the type of thing that I've been thinking about doing with this studio. And so, you know, it's a labor of love, and it's obviously a work in progress. As the entire Vortex is, we're still building it up. It's still a new thing, and trying to turn it into what, you know, Cameron and Jeff had, you know, envisioned as a model of something to help society. And as it evolves, you know, I'm taking this studio equipment, some of which is kind of older and, you know, not as, you know, robust as all new gear would be, but trying to apply it to the projects that Melvin and those types of groups are bringing in. So it's really challenging, and it's really fun in a lot of ways. They had me teach a group of people, you know, about what recording is, and I was able to kind of go just to square one and show exactly this is what a recording console is, this is how you record stuff, and to show them how they could apply that to, for example, YouTube, how they could do small things and put them up on YouTube and learn a little bit about it, so it's not so intimidating, because the process of recording is intimidating to people. So those are some of the kinds of things that I've been, you know, bringing into the mix.
I concur that some of our equipment is less than robust. And if anybody listening wants to support us and perhaps help us obtain more robust equipment, by all means, please consider visiting our website and making a donation. It's theveteransproject.org. And you'll see there's a page dedicated to Geza and his little department under our umbrella, which is called Hyper Activists.
Thank you.
And that is all about merging the arts and activism.
Yes, and the thing is that, you know, we're building up gradually enough of a presence and also, you know, working out all of the, you know, the various facets of how to do the things that we're doing because we're still figuring it out. And then we will, you know, apply for grants and donations and try to, you know, do it up properly because, of course, it needs staffing, it needs personnel, it needs equipment, it needs everything. I mean, right now it's just, you know, the few of us doing most or all of the work and then the community groups that come in doing the programs. But what we really need is, back in the day, Cameron could, you know, attest to this also, is that back in the 60s, there were all of these places where people could, you know, check in and volunteer and find places to sleep overnight and to, you know, contribute to whatever kind of work was needed. In other words, there was a very strong spirit of volunteerism. And that's been sort of lost. It's really actually very hard to find volunteers. Plus, when you have a thing that relies on a lot of tech, like, you know, a sound system or a, you know, stage system or a studio, then, of course, you have to train people. And then that means that they have to really care about what they're doing and want to stick around for a while. And it's hard to find people like that, you know. And we do that because we sort of come from that kind of background. But it's rare nowadays to find people that are into that.
Right. Well, I want to ask Jeff and Cameron both if, you know, what part of your vision that maybe isn't fully realized yet is on your mind. What is it that you want to see happen at the Vortex that's not quite there? Anything in particular?
Jeff, you want to take that?
Sure. I mean, I mentioned it last night, and I'd love to see more daytime programs or programs such as Melvin is doing, things that come back on a weekly basis, you know, classes or even social gatherings that happen on a weekly basis. We have some gamers that are now coming in on a semi-regular basis, and I'd love to see people return to the Vortex over and over again rather than just do a one-time event and leave, you know, because for some of the same reasons that Kaysa was mentioning. You know, we want people to think of this as a home for what it is that they're trying to do, and that, you know, that regular presence allows people to take some pride in the Vortex as theirs, and then it draws people in that way.
Totally. And then it builds community. And by building community, there's cross-pollination. And once there's cross-pollination, ideas start to form. And when the ideas start to form, people get hope. And they also get mobilized. And they start to do larger and larger projects. And that happens only when you get groups of people interacting with one another over a period of time.
Yeah, I would say that was part of the vision and is part of the vision. It comes with the variety, having a variety of causes using the space. That can be very strong. It can build networks between people who may have different causes but may have much more in common than they think. But yes, a variety of uses and causes is...
Right. Well, that's what I was alluding to before that I'm experiencing now. We are focusing on coming up with some solutions to the homelessness problem in the veteran population, and specifically kicking around ideas for different kinds of housing projects. Mm-hmm. And one that's generated a lot of enthusiasm so far is the idea of using shipping containers as homes and offices. Mm-hmm. And so this is bringing together very disparate elements of the community.
Perfect example.
Artists and architects and real estate developers and everything. It's really and it happens to be going on at a time when the climate is just so ripe for it. Mm-hmm. The mayor of Los Angeles has declared that veteran homelessness will end in Los Angeles by the end of 2015. And so,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a you know, it's a very ambitious goal, and whether or not it's going to happen is kind of beside the point. The point is there's a lot of energy and effort being directed in at this time. And the city of Phoenix already accomplished that goal.
Yeah.
And they did it by involving everybody. You know, the mayor led the effort there, but it was all different segments of the population. And we're sort of taking that as the inspiration. We're making it even more varied by, you know, using artists a little bit more, for example, than in Phoenix, and just getting people who come up with creative solutions. So did I have a feeling. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Jeff.
I was. Did anyone mention Brad? Did Brad Philman get a chance to call in? I mean, he's got a great program as well that he does on Sundays. That's just such a great community thing where people can come in and participate in theater with him, with that Dungeon Masters program that he does on Sundays.
Right. That's a perfect example of what you were saying about using the venue on a regular basis. And those guys really have their act together. Remember I was saying before, it's not so easy for everybody to set that place up. He has a team that, you know, sets up the stage and the whole, and just really transforms the venue into something.
It's amazing.
Quite, yeah. And that's not quite every Sunday, but on many Sundays, right?
Yes. They have regular seasons.
My hat's really off to people, you know, like that, that can come back on a regular basis. It just takes a tremendous amount of energy and dedication, and that crew definitely has it.
So that's Dungeon Masters, and I don't know if there's a link to them on the Vortex website, but I'm sure there's some mention of it, and I know they have a Facebook page. So if anybody wants to check them out, just go to Facebook and search Dungeon Masters.
It's Dungeon Masters singular, I believe. And it was designed many years ago as a conflict resolution tool for inner city youth. And so it's got quite a bit of depth behind it. It's also just a blast when you go there. It's just so funny.
And I also just want to mention that Cameron owns another venue in Hudson, New York, called Club Helsinki.
That's right.
And that's a much different kind of a concept. Do you want to just briefly mention that and tell folks what the website is if they want to explore that further?
Sure. If you're heading back east, Hudson, New York is 100 miles north of Manhattan, straight up the river. And we have a club there called Club Helsinki Hudson. It's a nightclub and restaurant and ballroom, and we do... we have Taj Mahal there coming up tomorrow night, if you're in the Hudson area and you're listening.
And even if you're not in the Hudson area, you have Taj Mahal
there. We still
there,
have Taj Mahal,
I imagine, yes.
And it's a, you know, it's a straight-ahead business, the restaurant and the nightclub. We do...
You make money off of that venture?
We try our best.
Oh, my goodness.
We try our best.
But I bet you do it with soul.
We try our best.
I can't wait to see it. I've read a lot of things about
it's
it.
It's beautiful.
Heard,
it's one of the most beautiful places.
Thank you. The website is HelsinkiHudson.com.
You sure?
I am sure.
HelsinkiHudson.com.
That's correct.
All right. Well, I love you guys. I was speaking to all three of you when I say that.
Love you too, Jeff.
Thank you. You are the salt of the earth.
Love all around.
And L.A. is very lucky to have folks like you contributing what you are contributing. And so I salute you for that. The website, again, is vortexla.org. Jeff, thank you for calling in. I will see you soon,
thanks.
I'm sure. Cam and Geza, thank you for coming here and enduring the less than comfortable climate here in the studio.
To me, this is heaven. I love the Sahara Desert.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Thank you, Jeff.
Okay, thank you so much. This is Jeff Norman. Thanks to all our listeners and to Jenny and all the good people at Skid Row Studios. We'll see you next week on The Norman Report. Ta-ta.
Jeff Norman, The Norman.